Impact of Influence, the Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth. Hello, friend. Matt Harris and Seton Tucker, always grateful to have you spend some time with us. If you want to find us, Seton, how do they do that?
You can find us on Facebook at Murdoch Podcast or on our website, which is murdochpodcast.com.
Anyone send an email, mattharrispodcast@gmail.com. And do we just, as we've said a million times, we're just so grateful. We never thought that we'd have a podcast that had this many people listening. So thank you. And we've met so many really cool people and great people throughout the course of this journey. And one of them is the Hampton County native, Michael DeWitt. He's a multiple award-winning journalist, longtime editor of the 143-year-old The Hampton County Guardian. He's had boots on the ground, the coverage of all the Murdoch things going way back to Stephen Smith, been published and printed online through Gannett's nationwide USA Today network. And we are so happy to have him join us. We'll talk about the books that he has coming out. He already has one out. And we'll get into that in a moment. But Michael joins us. So Michael, I see you've been on, 2020 and 48 Hours and Dateline, the Netflix documentary. Did you ever in your wildest imagination think you'd be in all these national programs and the documentaries?
No, absolutely not. I never thought I'd see the day when I'd see a Murdoch wearing handcuffs and a jumpsuit. So all of this has just been shocking, new, wild, crazy, you name it. It's been all that.
At the beginning of this whole saga, let's even go back 5 years or so, did you have a vibe or the town have a vibe that the Murdoch were above the law? Or was it a whisper? Or was it a shout? Or was it not even thought of?
Growing up in Hampton County in my generation, we knew who the Murdochs were. I mean, if you were in the 14th Circuit, you pretty much knew. If you were in Hampton County, everybody knew the Murdochs. You know, in my case, I went to school with them, and Alex's mother was one of my teachers, and then later served on the school board. But my generation, we always heard rumors, allegations of corruption in the past and that kind of thing. So we weren't really surprised by that. Randolph III, Alex's father, was, a lot cleaner than his dad was and Buster was. And when he retired, he was still highly regarded, well-respected. It was around 2015 when Stephen Smith's body showed up in the middle of the road and we started hearing these rumors. That's when people in the community really began to question, had these people been getting away with things for too long,
I get asked the question all the time when we first started this podcast, were you scared to speak out against the Murdoch family? And I always responded, I personally was never scared of anything other than getting sued. How did you feel?
Well, I guess it's been different for me than pretty much anybody. You know, of all the hundreds of people, and I'm not trying to sound special or anything, but I'm in a unique position. Of all the hundreds of journalists around the world covering this case, I'm the only one that has to live here.
You have to see him in the grocery store.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see him in the store. When the international media goes away, I live here. When Stephen Smith happened in 2015, Alex's mother was on the school board. My kids were in the school, and she was chairman of the school board. So I wasn't scared. It was a healthy respect. I wrote stories about the Murdochs, good and bad, but I always tried to make sure they were factual, well-documented. If I put the Murdoch name out there, this is a family of lawyers, so I'm going to make sure I have my facts and I have my documents. And I did my job, but I did it with a healthy respect. People have asked me before, were you ever scared? Have the Murdochs ever threatened you or anything like that? And it's kind of funny. There's this misconception that this is a Dixie Mafia, Southern Mafia kind of family, that if you cross them, you might end up dead in a ditch somewhere. That's not who these people are. Their power is in connections and in the courtroom. And when I published some controversial stories about the Murdochs after Stephen Smith's death. It was related to another local scandal, if you will. I didn't get any threats. Libby Murdoch, Alex's mother, called me up and invited me to come eat supper with him. Said, why don't you come over here to Alameda, eat dinner with us, and maybe we can give you some information that might be some things that you don't know behind the scenes that might help you with your next story. And so naturally, I politely declined the dinner invitation, but that was the only interaction I've ever had with the Murdoch throughout this entire ordeal. Was not a threat, but a dinner invitation.
Interesting.
Just as a journalist, I mean, it probably is good to separate yourself so you don't get too close, so you are able to objectively look at what's going on.
I can answer that or address that very, very directly. Before Stephen Smith died, I was invited often to events hosted by Randolph or hosted by the law firm. And some of them were purely for coverage and some of them were social. And I've been to Randolph's house and, every third Thursday, Randolph Murdoch would and Alameda would have a cookout, and all the men, all his buddies and cronies, the mayor, the county councilman, the editor of the paper, they were all invited, and it'd be a fish fry or a barbecue or whatever. And so I'd go to those sometimes, you know. And after Stephen Smith, even though there's no direct evidence that shows that Murdoch's had anything to do with his death, there were a lot of rumors going around the community. As of that moment, I quit socially interacting with the Murdoch family and I distanced myself. I still covered events as a journalist when Randolph was awarded Order of the Palmetto in 2018. I was there at the courthouse. I took pictures or did a story. And so I still did my job. I still interacted with them on a professional level. But when Stephen Smith died, I began to put some space between myself socially, between myself and members of that family.
Interesting. A little bit behind the scenes question for you. Like on, say, the Netflix doc, people don't probably understand how that works. I'm guessing that they filmed hours of you talking, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was multiple interviews, 2 or 3 hours each time. There's a lot of footage they didn't use, obviously. They filmed me driving down the road, talking to them while I'm driving, and they didn't use any of that. But it's part of the process. They may use it in a later show. They may never use it, but they find local people who know the story. They find local reporters like me, and they amplify these local voices to a national or international worldwide audience. I think they're in multiple countries around the world. Sure. But that's all part of the process. You sit for hours and you might see just a few minutes here and there on the screen, but it wasn't just me. I think it was a lot of people.
Did you have a makeup and hair person?
No, didn't do any makeup and hair. When I did, I did one major network. They asked me to take my glasses off, and I'm blind as a bat without my glasses. So I sat there with my glasses beside me on the desk, not seeing a thing. I think Dateline put a little bit of something on my forehead so my forehead wouldn't shine so much. But yeah, I never did any makeup or hair.
You don't have your own trailer.
They do stick a microphone down your shirt.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
You had an article titled "A Boat Crash Heard Around the World." And I wanted to ask you about how you think local media's coverage kind of got the ball rolling and made this a national story.
That's a good question. Stephen Smith was a Hampton County story. It started out. Now, of course, it isn't. But when Stephen Smith happened, it was a Hampton County scandal. It was our little dirty secret. If you saw the articles that we did going back to Thanksgiving of 2015, we pleaded with the community for information and answers, and we didn't get anywhere, you know. And the boat crash made this a South Carolina story. People all over the low country and all over the state became aware of what was going on. Let me more accurately phrase that. people around the state were introduced to the Murdoch family through this boat crash. I certainly didn't break any news in that story. That didn't happen in my county. It happened over in Beaufort County, Beaufort Gazette, Island Packet. They did a great job of jumping on that story and digging. State paper, John Monk came to town, and all of these dirty Hampton County secrets that we had known for generations about Buster and the Murdoch dynasty was kind of old news to us. We didn't really think it was anything, you know, everybody knew it, but for the rest of the state, it was a very exciting backstory. So we didn't just have this crash where a young lady was tragically killed. We had a member of the Murdoch family, and then the media starts going back generations and saying, oh man, there's quite a story here going back to Randolph and Senior and Buster. And so at that point, it became a South Carolina story, and I was just one of the many people telling it. I think the reporters, I like to give credit where it's due, and the reporters in Beaufort County and other major papers around the state just did an excellent job. And at that time, I was just a small town editor, just doing my best to try to keep up with the daily papers and to try to tell the story the best I could to the people of Hampton County.
That John Monk story, where he really goes and does a deep dive into the Murdoch family, I think I've read that story about 10 times. It was really impacted me when it first came out. And I think that was one of the things that really got me hooked on this story.
Yeah. John, I was talking to him a few times during the trials. We all were. At one point, I go, you know, John, you're a legend. He goes, ah, geez, that just means I'm old. And that says it all.
I agree with you. He is a legend. And that story, I wish I would have written it. And it's one of those things about its perspective. How can I say it? What's the expression? You can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
If you're living in the middle of something, it's not a story to you. My people have known this for generations. We didn't think it was anything. But if you're not from Hampton County, wow, what a story, you know?
Right.
So
you do have a book, though, that just came out where you are telling the story. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, actually, two books. And, you know, this goes back to I've been kind of forced to evolve from a country editor into a national journalist and now into an author. A lot of people are getting the wrong idea about Hampton County and the wrong idea about this Murdoch dynasty. And I'd already been doing some research beforehand. So over the past year, I finished my research efforts, and I've written two books. One is Wicked Hampton County that will publish May 29th. And the second book I'm putting the finishing touches on now with the new information from the trial. And that is called Follow the House of Murdoch. And it is expected to publish in June, unless we get some new amazing information or new secrets. It will publish in June. And Wicked Hampton County takes a look at all of Hampton County's dark history, going back to over a couple hundred years. And it includes the Murdoch, a condensed version of the Murdoch family's dynasty. Fall of the House of Murdoch is all about the Murdoch dynasty. It goes back to the days of the Confederacy, and it talks about that legal and political dynasty, how it came to power, how it made questionable use of that power over the years, and how Alex and to some extent Paul Murdoch brought about the fall of this dynasty. And I think both of them are well-documented, well-researched, and I hope they're going to be well-read.
I hope so, too.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. I will have some time after the last few years to read again, so
yes.
I'm looking forward to definitely reading them. Another thing, I read your article this morning in the Greenville News. I think you quoted Jay Bender, who was the liaison for the media during the course of this trial, and you talked about Judge Newman's transparency, but initially, it was kind of difficult to get some of the records from the court system. Did you find that in the course of your reporting?
Yes, we saw that with the boat crash, and we saw that with the double homicide at Moselle. Police were very tight-lipped. With Boat Crash, you could get information a little easier, but you didn't. They weren't just, you know, handing it out willy-nilly. You had to put in freedom of information request, and you had to chase after it. With the homicides, they were very tight-lipped because of the family and the nature of the crimes. They kept everything they possibly could under wraps for as long as they could. And from a media standpoint, you know, we cried foul. We wanted information. From a police standpoint, maybe that was crucial to the investigation. You know, keep it under wraps. They knew Alex Murdaugh was their only suspect back in August, but they, you know, maybe they didn't want the rest of the world to know that. And so there's two ways to look at that. But what started as a very media unfriendly crime saga definitely ended in full transparency, thanks to Judge Newman. And I think that was just been great.
Yeah, I agree. You still live in this community. What is next for Hampton, and how do they move on from this intense media coverage?
What's next for Hampton County?
that might be a tough question for one person to answer.
Yeah, really.
Well, I did a story. I think it published yesterday. The stories are starting to kind of blur together for me a little bit. I wrote it Friday, and I think it published yesterday, called basically Healing Hampton County and How We Move On. And the, you know, there's two answers to that question. It's going to be a long time before the community as a whole can put this behind them. I mean, we still got more crimes to deal with. We still got a dozen lawsuits to deal with.
Yep.
The Mallory Beach boat crash case is going to be heard in Hampton County on August 14th, unless it's rescheduled again. So Hampton County is not done with this story. The rest of the world might have began the process of moving on. The media circus has packed up the tents and left Walterboro, South Carolina. But here in Hampton, we still, as I said in the story, we still, you know, drive under the shadow of the law firm. We still do business at Pyman Estate Bank, where Alex Murdaugh stole millions. For the community, it's going to take time, but for the families and the victims, they will never truly move on from this. Yeah. There'll be some healing and some forgetting or forgiveness, but they'll never truly move on.
Are the people from Hampton ready to get out from under this spotlight?
I think the people of Hampton are sick and tired of hearing about this story. You know, it has dominated the headlines here like it has anywhere else. But more importantly, people of Hampton County are still very much divided. I've seen posts on social media where people still believe Alex Murdaugh is innocent of killing his family. I've seen posts mocking Alex and condemning the whole family in general, but primarily Alex. I've seen posts defending Alex. I've seen local people just simply say, hey, let's just offer some forgiveness and leave this family alone and let them, you know, move on. So whatever feelings and sentiments that people around the state and around the country and the world are feeling, just amplify those by 100 and you get the feelings that people in Hampton County have.
Michael, you're the best, man. You know, we met you long, long time ago in the beginning of this process, and you were cool to us, and we appreciate that. And we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us. It's very nice. And we'll look for those books soon.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. And I'm not an investigative reporter by nature. It doesn't come natural to me. And I'm not an aggressive reporter, but I do try to do this job without being a jerk. And I really appreciate working with nice people. And you guys have just been super nice. And it's been a pleasure to meet you and get to know you.
Okay. You just shocked me that you're not, you know, investigative journalism does not come naturally to you, because we would never known that.
Yeah.
I'm a storyteller. Before all this happened, I was a humorist. I wrote Southern humor. I wrote about the outdoors. I wrote for South Carolina Wildlife Magazine, Sporting Classics. All I ever wanted to be was a Louis Grizzard of Hampton County or the Lowcountry. And this story has kind of forced me to evolve and become more of an investigative reporter, more of a, well, it's made me a national reporter, when before all I was a small town country editor. So I kind of tried to rise to the challenge, and some days I do pretty good.
Yeah,
some days
great.
I could use a little work.
You do great, and you're a good dude, and we appreciate that about you even more. So again, Michael, thanks, and we will probably be talking again because this thing's not quite over yet.
Oh, absolutely. If I can help you at any time, just give me a call.
You're the best. Thanks, great. Michael.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Later, man.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
And so it's back-to-back interviews today. Seton, bring in our next guest.
We are very excited to have a local Aubrey Dempsey on to answer a few questions that we've had from listeners. So, Aubrey, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born and raised in Varnville, grew up here and went to school with the Murdoch boys. I've known them all my life, known their parents as well, and got interested in these cases, obviously, because it's really right out in my backyard is where everything's happened. And so I took an interest in it from that perspective. And then as a result, I got involved with one of the Reddit subs on the topic, and it has grown to be the largest sub that's covering the Murdoch crimes, as well as two of the largest Facebook groups that I admin. So,
and what are those groups again?
It is Murdoch Family Murders on Reddit, and then Horror in Hampton, as well as Murdoch Mayhem on Facebook.
And along with doing that, as we have experienced too, it's not always love and roses sent your way, is it?
No, it's definitely not. I've been accused of all kinds of things. I've been accused of being on the Murdoch payroll.
Join the club.
As of yet, no check has arrived.
yeah, no kidding, right?
I know, we're still waiting for ours.
Yeah, you know, eventually the checks will come in, but I'm afraid they won't be worth cashing once Palmetto State reopens. So, you know. but yeah, I've been accused of all kinds of things, but I am who I say I am. I'm not, it's no mystery. I don't hide. Anybody who knows me. And the people who interact with me know that I'm pretty straightforward. I've said from the beginning, all I want is the truth. Whatever the truth is and wherever it leads and whosever doorstep it ends up at, it's fine. I don't really care. It's just as long as it's the truth itself and not someone's version of the truth. Just the facts. That's all I care about.
Well, one question that we have gotten a lot since the release of the Netflix special was about this drone footage that shows John Marvin removing guns from the Moselle property. Can you tell us your knowledge of what happened?
I can. I became friends with Eric Allen a while back. He and I interacted some regarding these cases and specifically the boat crash. We were friends before the murders happened. And then we interacted some, and he contacted me and said that they were executing search warrants at Moselle that afternoon. And it was just happened to be the day that he and I were supposed to follow up on a couple of things. So I said, hey, I'll just meet you out there. And so met him, was on the side of the road with him while he had the drone in the air. We talked, you know, sled vehicles were coming and going. You could see a lot of activity on the ground, you know, through the monitor of the drone itself. And he recorded a bunch of footage. And then it turned out later on that there was some footage in there of John Marvin and Buster removing guns from the property, as well as some other things. We couldn't really tell what they were in that crate that they had. And it turns out that all of that was done, of course, after Sled had already released the property. So there's really nothing nefarious there that I could find. And to me, it seems logical that you would not want to keep firearms in an unoccupied residence that's currently the center of national attention. You know, everybody knows that nobody lives there. So it just makes sense that you'd want to take those firearms and put them away somewhere secure for safekeeping. I probably would have moved them before September came.
Right. So the way it's shot or explained is this implication that John Marvin and Buster were, you know, secretly removing weapons and
maybe
possibly the murder weapons.
Yeah, maybe that's where the murder weapons
and,
went.
Yeah, and they're taking them out somewhere to dump them, and they get the dog in the back of the pickup, if I remember right, too. You're saying that your knowledge was Sled had released the house. There was, and it would make sense to remove guns from a house where no one lived and many people were interested in. You know, there was all kinds of people hovering around the property, especially after September, when the Labor Day suicide for hire thing, that's when really the bright lights really super shined on Alec and Moselle, and the interest even picked up more, as you know, and we know from covering this. I mean, that's when it really, really got intensified, I believe.
That's exactly right. And the date on this footage was about 10 days after the roadside shooting incident.
Okay.
So it was just getting ramped up.
Well, that's the main thing we brought you in for. Do you have anything you'd like to say about the boat crash or what's coming up with that you want to fill us in on?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out and how a jury is going to find it. I think there's a lot of controversy still and discussion and conflict in testimony, conflict in depositions as to what actually happened and who did what. So it'll be interesting to see how the attorneys bring that out and how a jury finds it.
Thank you for joining us and straightening some of that stuff out. Always have enjoyed your take on all of this and the fact that to me, I'm sure I can speak for Seton on this, you've been fair about what you've done and what you've said. It's never been a hit piece. It's been fair analysis, and that's rare in this day and time.
No, and I've actually talked with Aubrey about possibly kind of compiling a list of things that have come out to be true and also inaccuracies in a lot of the reporting throughout this whole saga.
Almost 2 years, yeah. Or more if you go out to the boat case and Stephen Smith. So, yeah, Aubrey, we appreciate your work. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
All right, you can always reach out to us at the places we've mentioned, like murdochpodcast.com and the Murdoch Podcast Facebook page. We appreciate Michael and Aubrey joining us. And here's an email from Ruth, because I was on Court TV the other night and we were talking about the boat crash that killed Mallory Beach. And she says, Dear Matt and Seton, I think it's very important to let kids know they can call and get a ride home from an unsafe situation, no questions asked. So often kids are in bad situations, don't have the confidence or experience to know they should opt out. It's heartbreaking to see the images of Mallory Beach at the Buford Marina. Thank you for bringing it up on Court TV. There are some bad decisions. There's no coming back from. Wish your podcast could spearhead an effort to get that message out there and bring more people on board. Hashtag remember Mallory. Best wishes from Ruth and Okotee, South Carolina. She's referring to one of the things I mentioned on the episode with Vinnie Politan was that, and this is in no way shading anybody that was on that boat at all, but I have talked about this with my 17-year-old daughter. You grew up in the area. I talked about the specific case, and I said about, because we've had the talk about drinking and driving, but this is a true case about boating and how important it is when you're going out on a boat to know who is captaining that boat. Is he a responsible person? Does he have lights on the boat? Are there life jackets available? It's not something you play with. You don't go on the boat so you can drink and not get pulled over by cops. It is a place that you treat just like you do a car, and that you need to be very responsible and be very aware of who is the captain of that ship. And if you ever call me, I don't care how far away you are or what's going on, I will come get you. If you have a chance to get off that boat, I will come get you. There'll be no questions asked and we'll be on our way. And I know that this rings true with you because you grew up on these waterways in that area, and especially decades ago, not that you're that old, but sometimes it's taken
light. It is decades ago.
Yes. It's sometimes taken lightly, right? The boating and drinking isn't as thought about as hard as the drinking and driving of a car.
Oh, I mean, we see it on Lake Wylie too. I mean, I think people sometimes have a false sense of security that it's not a roadway and maybe you can't get in trouble. But I mean, we definitely, it's a good message to get out there. And I think it's also a good way to honor Mallory Beach.
Agreed. Murdoch Podcast Facebook, murdochpodcast.com, Matt Harris Podcast at gmail.com. And as always, we're grateful and we'll talk soon, friend.